Included Alonso, Marejada Feliz, and by Pedro Flores, the second cut. So this is Latin Explosion. See you next week.
SLR News headlines for Friday, September 12th. The Sarasota School District could be closing down one of its elementary schools due to low student numbers. At a special meeting on Tuesday, Wilkinson Elementary was in an unwanted spotlight when staffers explained that the school operates at half capacity. They laid out plans to the school board members that would move students to three other schools, renovate the aging building, and relocate the school district offices there. The school board did not make a decision yet. A state law makes it easier for for-profit charter schools called Schools of Hope to claim unused public school buildings. The district would have to help fund any School of Hope operating out of Wilkinson. Superintendent Terry Connor talked about public schools in the district being on a, quote, path of declining enrollment. Among the schools with shrinking student numbers are Booker Elementary and Booker Middle, the area schools that have historically taught most African-American students. The Statewide Association of Realtors says James Buchanan should be handed the keys to a Florida Senate seat. The Florida Realtors PAC is endorsing the Sarasota Republican in the district currently represented by Joe Gruters. Gruters cannot run again because he's term limited and he was recently picked to head the National Republican Party. The Realtors picked Buchanan, they said, because he himself is a real estate agent. Buchanan, son of U.S. Representative Vern Buchanan, is representing a district in South Sarasota County in the Florida House. The Senate district is heavily Republican, and no Democratic candidate challenged Gruters in 2022. In November, more than 58% of voters in the district picked Trump in the presidential race. Historically black universities throughout the South, including in Florida, have locked down and urged students to stay in place after receiving credible threats. That includes Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach. The other universities that locked down are Virginia University, Spelman College, Atlanta Clark University, and Southern University. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, September 12th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. The recent shakedowns of the tech industry, including allowing chipmaker NVIDIA to sell an advanced artificial intelligence chip to China for billions in exchange for a 15% levy on the sales, and taking a 10% stake in Intel worth $11 billion in exchange for paying out grants that had previously been awarded under President Joe Biden's U.S. Chips and Science Act, is just the start of this government's extortion racket. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick this week floated the idea of getting a cut of money earned from patents that were developed with the use of federal research grants. Lutnick posits that if a business funded research that resulted in a lucrative patent, the company would take as much as half the profit. Currently, under federal law, universities, businesses, and nonprofits that receive federal grants are allowed to pursue and retain ownership of any patents that result. Lutnick, supposing this extra revenue could be used to shore up Social Security or pay down the deficit, or most likely provide bigger tax cuts for the wealthy. Notably, Lutnick didn't say anything about putting the touch on Elon Musk's Tesla and SpaceX, which, according to the Washington Post, have received at least $38 billion in government funding. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my interview with Dan Vicuna, Senior Director of Voting and Fair Representation for Common Cause, who will break down the consequences of the mid-census redistricting. But first, hear how the president wants more praying in schools, just as long as it's the right kind. President Donald Trump told attendees of the Religious Liberty Commission meeting this week that new guidance will be released regarding prayer in public schools. I'm pleased to announce this morning that the Department of Education will soon issue new guidance protecting the right to prayer in our public schools, Trump said at a meeting. The exact time of the new guidance announcement was not immediately clear. For most of our country's history, the Bible was found in every classroom in the nation. Yet, in many schools today, students are indoctrinated with anti-religious propaganda, Trump said during the meeting at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., adding that some have already been punished for their religious beliefs. The commission was established by Trump in an executive order issued in May, with the president appointing Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick as chairman and Dr. Ben Carson as vice chair. According to the White House website, the commission was created to, quote, advise the White House Faith Office and Domestic Policy Council on religious liberty policies of the United States. Part of that directive includes creating way to secure religious liberty both in the U.S. and abroad. A cultural and legal battle surrounding prayer in public schools continues to play out in the United States, with some states proposing laws to further religious expression in school. The Supreme Court recently upheld a ruling that would not allow Oklahoma to launch the country's first religious public charter school. Now the Oscars need to rethink their standards. Tom Hanks wins and no statue for Scott Baio or Kid Rock? Something must be wrong. Donald Trump demanded the Oscars rewrite their rule book after an award honoring Tom Hanks was axed. Tom Hanks was to be honored by the Alum Association of the U.S. Military Academy West Point with its 2025 Sylvanus Thayer Award, the organization's top civilian honor. Trump has praised the West Point U-turn and now wants the Oscars to make changes. Posting on Truth Social, Trump cheered our great West Point getting greater all the time and smartly canceled the award ceremony for actor Tom Hanks. Important move. We don't need destructive woke recipients getting our cherished American awards. Calling on the Academy Awards, known as the Oscars, to follow suit, which he claimed would see them become more popular with the viewing public, he added, hopefully the Academy Awards and other fake award shows will review their standards and practices in the name of fairness and justice. Watch their dead ratings surge. The Washington Post first reported that the West Point Association of Graduates would not be honoring Hanks this year. The Sylvanus Thayer Award honors an outstanding citizen who did not attend West Point, but embodies duty, honor, and country. The alumni group announced Hanks's selection in June, praising decades of work portraying and supporting service members and veterans. Tom Hanks has done more for the positive portrayal of American service member than many other Americans. Board Chairman Robert McDonald said at the time, Hanks is a longtime advocate for veterans and military heritage, from his roles in Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers to support to support for the Eisenhower Memorial and the National Museum, National World War II Museum. He spoke at a Biden fundraiser in 2020 and hosted the Celebrating America broadcast in 2021. Whether Hanks, who has previously been critical of Trump, will still receive the medal remains unclear. However, the Post reported that the cancellation of the ceremony at which he would have been honored followed political turbulence at the Academy this year. Jason Dempsey, an alum and former instructor, said it looked like leaders would have been uncomfortable in the current environment. It is a perfect example of someone being good for the military, but not perfectly aligned with the current partisan priorities. There's no indication that the White House ordered the event scrapped. The Daily Beast has contacted the Academy of Motion Pictures for comment. LADIPO is ready to end vaccines, but the data tracking their use and effectiveness is strangely missing from the state websites. Missing data in a key state health report raised new questions about transparency from Florida Department of Health. The Vaccine Preventable Disease Report, published monthly on the department's website, tracks illnesses such as hepatitis, pertussis, whooping cough, and varicella chickenpox, but recent months showed a sudden and unexplained absence of public data. The report archive typically provides monthly updates on activity of vaccine-preventable diseases. For example, in April 2025, the department reported an increase in hepatitis A, pertussis, and varicella cases, while meningococcal disease activity was below average. However, reports for May, June, July, and August 2025 are missing from the archive. The discovery comes after Florida Surgeon General Dr. Joseph LADIPO publicly called for an end to vaccine mandates, including those for school children. I think it's much more important that parents have the right and ability to decide what enters their children's bodies, LADIPO said during a recent interview. The News 4 Jack's Eye team reached out to the Florida Department of Health for clarification on the missing reports and whether the data will be available to the public in the future. As a publication, the department has not responded. Experts said the availability of public health data is critical for both transparency and informed decision-making, particularly during debates over public policy. Certainly, in cases like this where we're talking about infectious diseases, I don't see any reason to withhold information, said Dr. Jonathan Cantor, an adjunct fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. We are living in a time where information is weaponized, but having data on rates of infectious disease before and after vaccine programs is obviously very, very useful, he said. As for the impact of lifting vaccine mandates, Cantor said the actual health effects may be more limited than some assume. It's a very small number of people, and those people could get exemptions anyway before, he said. To pretend that somehow having a loss of a mandate is going to have a massive impact, I don't know if that's really the case. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. So far, all the state has done to fix the insurance crisis is to help insurance companies. In March 2023, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill into law meant to curb frivolous lawsuits that he said were raising insurance rates for customers while enriching predatory lawyers and scaring off insurance carriers. But a new analysis suggests the law, which has served as a model for other states, may have benefited insurance companies more than it has protected consumers. The number of lawsuits filed by policyholders whose insurance claims have been denied stayed high, topping all other states, according to data obtained by the Washington Post. Meanwhile, Floridians have continued to pay some of the highest insurance premiums in the country. While Florida insurance officials say that the rates have dropped, reporting by the Tampa Bay Times and other outlets on the state shows that people are still seeing rate hikes. although the jumps are lower than in some previous years. Some residents also told the Post they'd seen their insurance costs increase since 2022. In 2024, nearly 13% of Florida homeowners whose claims were denied sued their insurance company, compared with 12.4% in 2022. According to the data from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, compiled by Weiss Ratings, an independent insurance ratings company. Martin Weiss, an economist and founder of Weiss Ratings and other experts, said the continuous flow of claims is not a reflection of frivolous lawsuits, but a pushback on insurers who have closed a record amount of claims while scaling back coverage. Also in 2024, a year in which three major storms hit the region, insurance companies denied more claims in Florida than they had in previous years and closed out 47% of damage claims without payment, the highest share in nearly 10 years, the data shows. Throughout the country, academic studies have documented how insurance companies have sought to pass the costs and risks of home insurance on to consumers, as extreme weather fueled by climate change has increased those costs and risks. The Florida law may have further emboldened insurance companies to be aggressive with low payments or claim denials, since they believed that they would be less likely to be taken to court. According to consumer advocates, tort reform experts, Florida justice groups, and attorneys who spoke with the Post. After disaster strikes, people can be desperate to get the money that they need to rebuild, and in the past, insurance companies have used it as a way to have lowball offers accepted, said Anders Croy, a spokesman for Florida Watch, a progressive advocacy group for state's residents. Now companies are just trying to close those legitimate claims without paying a cent, which is leading people to contact an attorney to get what they're owed. Industry representatives, however, disagree. Mark Friedlander, a spokesman for the Insurance Information Institute, said Florida residents are in a much better place because of legislative changes that curbed legal system abuse. With the large reduction in defense costs, containment expenses due to court reform, Florida insurers can now write profitable business in all regions of the state, despite the ongoing risk of land-falling hurricanes, he said. Friedlander said that the NAIC data does not appear to be accurate, as lawsuits have declined significantly since tort reform. Industry experts agree that Florida's market is the healthiest it's been in nearly a decade, said Shiloh Elliott, press secretary at the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation, adding that the rates are declining. The office, she said, also recently issued penalties to 8 insurers totaling more than $2 million for misconduct during past hurricanes, showing a commitment to consumer protection and insurer accountability. Last month, 3 days after the Post reached out to industry representatives about the data compiled by Weiss, state regulators proposed a rule that would require insurance companies to submit more detailed information about their litigation and property insurance disputes that had previously been required, though some of those demands had already existed since 2021. But insurance experts and advocates argue that the changes only allow companies to profit further because lawsuits make claims vastly more expensive. These lawsuits more often favor the individual making the claim and the payouts much higher, though they can go on for years, according to attorneys and consumer advocacy groups. Florida's 2022 tort reforms only benefited insurance companies who continue profiting while aggressively denying policyholder claims, said Hillary Casale, a Florida state representative, attorney, and insurance expert. When asked to describe frivolous lawsuits, Friedlander said they're typically lawsuits being filed by billboard attorneys that lack solid legal or factual basis and are considered meritless. But some attorneys call that an industry narrative. While there are bad actors, they say, those are the minority. All attorneys in Florida are bound by the same ethical rules, and we would be admonished by the Florida Bar if we were continuing to bring frivolous lawsuits, said David Lippman, the chief legal officer at Florida-based Canner and Petugla. Judges would not waste time on frivolous lawsuits. Instead, Lippman added, if Florida carriers would pay claims fairly, there wouldn't be the need for so many lawsuits. Cassell and others argue that the root of the issue in Florida's insurance market are systemic and come from a lack of regulation allowing for small carriers to start up and operate with little in the bank compared with the risk as climate change and development worsen disasters. Homelessness is rising as rent climbs. Homelessness among Florida families rose by 28% in the last 3 years, a report from the University of Florida found. The 2025 rental market study conducted by UF Schimburg Center for Housing Studies found that the rent for multifamily units in Florida rose by 39% between 2019 and 2023 as 1 million households entered the state. Florida's strong population growth has collided with limited housing supply, pushing rents beyond what many families can afford, said Ann Ray, manager of the Florida Housing Data Clearinghouse at the Schimburg Center. According to the report, an estimated 904,000 renting households earn less than 60% of the median income and pay more than 40% of their income on housing. Florida is not any different than other places, and we saw that the extreme rise in rents going back to the pandemic days and things that have remained high as production pretty much came to a grinding halt for that period of time, Florida Housing Coalition CEO Aston Nesbitt told the Phoenix. The state added more than 240,000 multifamily units between 2019 and 2023, while median rents rose by almost $500 a month, or 39%, from $1,238 to $1,719, a report found. Renting households include at least one employed adult in 79% of the units. The households occupied by their owners, 67%, are working. We're still not producing as quickly as the need is overall, Nesbitt said, adding that there's a great need for rental properties for people making below 80% of the median income. Financially, it's difficult to produce units at that level, so with the lack of units affordable at that level, the overall lack of supplies, we have high rents, and the reduction in supply is related to that growth and those that are now becoming homeless, Nesbitt said. The study found the largest inflow of residents in the state stretched from St. Johns County to Lee County. The report, using Department of Housing and Urban Development and Florida Department of Education data, estimates 29,848 individuals in Florida are homeless, 6,049 of whom are unaccompanied youth. The report estimates that 41,847 families are doubled up with others or staying in hotels or motels. The 2025 homelessness numbers represent a 14% increase for individuals and a 28% increase for families since the 2022 report. Nesbitt said that down the line there will be more supply as projects draw on trust funds like the Live Local Act, land use tools, and property tax exemptions are built. As conversations ramp up about eliminating property taxes, Nesbitt said he expects people to consider how it will affect low to moderate income homeowners and show it can be done equitably based on income and other factors. Many of the folks that are experiencing that instability are part of our workforce. Most of the folks that this report calls out, these are the folks that are working jobs and working many of the jobs that power our state's economy, Nesbitt said. Meanwhile, middle-class income is stagnant, while the rich just keep getting richer. Middle-income U.S. households saw essentially flat incomes last year. the affluent saw a significant pay bump. That's a key takeaway from the Census Bureau's annual report on income poverty and health insurance coverage out this week. The median U.S. household income was $83,730 in 2024, an inflation-adjusted 1.3% bump that the Census Bureau said was not statistically different from $82,690,000 in 2023. However, at the top of the income distribution, the 90th percentile, inflation-adjusted income rose 4.2% to $251,000. Incomes at the 10th percentile were up 2.2% at $19,000. The poverty rate fell 0.4% to 10.6%. There were big differences among racial groups. Median income increased by 5.5% among Hispanics from 2023 to 2024, 5.1% among Asian Americans, and 1.4% among white Americans. Median income fell 3.3% in inflation-adjusted terms for black Americans. With middle-income earners seeing modest and non-existent income bumps last year, it is less surprising that public opinion on the economy remained sharply negative. Democrat Jennifer Jenkins is running for senator. Jennifer Jenkins, who first made headlines when she beat Tina Descovich, co-founder of the far-right Moms for Liberty and Brevard County, Florida school board race in 2020, announced this week that she's running for U.S. Senate in Florida. Under the leadership of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, the state has become the poster child for right-wing extremism that has saturated school board races around the country. And Moms for Liberty, an extremist group that purports to support parental rights and has been behind the wave of right-wing school board takeovers, was founded in Florida and has wielded influence over the state's education policies. Jenkins surprised political experts in Florida when she beat Descovich, the incumbent, by nearly 10 points. "When the school board wasn't delivering, I decided to run myself," Jenkins said in a campaign launch video, "and despite the odds, I won in a county that Trump won by double digits." Jenkins has long pushed back on the parental rights movement, whose leaders say parents should be the final decision makers when it comes to their child's education. The movement has been behind the conservative charge to ban books with racial justice and LGBTQ plus themes, censor what teachers can say in the classroom, and craft policies attacking transgender youth. In 2024, Jenkins founded Educated We Stand, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to fighting extremism in public schools across the country. Nearly 80% of the group's endorsed candidates won their races that year, including in Florida and Wisconsin. Jenkins is ready to expand her work. "I don't want to fight the culture wars anymore. I never did," Jenkins said, "but I refuse to back away from defending people who are being marginalized and attacked. The most important issue for Floridians is the affordability crisis," she added. "Property insurance, groceries, rent, utilities keep increasing, and we have career politicians who refuse to do anything about it." Culture wars have been injected into all sorts of political races across the country for the last few years. School board candidates in states including Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida promised voters they would remove sexually explicit materials from schools and keep transgender kids from playing sports or using the bathroom that matched their gender identity. They saw varying degrees of success. Moms for Liberty's big push to take over Pennsylvania schools fell short, while right-wing school board candidates in Texas were able to win majorities. Republican Glenn Youngkin won the Virginia gubernatorial race in 2021, partially because of parental rights concerns. Democrats, meanwhile, largely struggle to respond to the movement, with some attempting to appease conservatives by trying to meet in the middle on the question of civil rights for trans kids, and other calling for far-right movement a distraction from the real issues. Outside observers believe Jenkins' candidacy is a long shot, as Democrats in Florida have suffered several major losses in the last decade. The last Democrat to be elected to the U.S. Senate in Florida was Bill Nelson in 2012. He lost his 2018 re-election bid to Senator Rick Scott. But Jenkins thinks it's a mistake to write off Florida as a lost cause for progressives. I reject the idea that the state isn't winnable for Democrats. We don't have to give up our state to one-party rule, she said. This is my future. This is my 9-year-old daughter's future. I'm not going to give up. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Dan Vicuna from Common Cause.
I'm Lou Lorini, and I'm happy to welcome Dan Vicuna, Senior Director of Voting and Fair Representation for Common Cause, which is a nonpartisan grassroots organization dedicated to upholding the core values of American democracy. Hey, thanks for joining us today, Dan. How you doing?
I'm fine, Dan. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. I understand you're leading the effort by Common Cause to fight partisan gerrymandering and support fair redistricting maps, considering what Republicans are trying to do, to preserve their slim majority in the House in the 2026 midterms. You must be pretty busy these days.
We are. Well, partisan gerrymandering has a long and troubled history in the United States, right? It's a way that politicians use their power to draw districts where they still have the power. We've been fighting against that for a long time, but where they still have the power to manipulate districts for partisan advantage. And, we think that redistricting should be all about community needs. What do people need in terms of environmental resources, housing, transportation availability? Yeah, and that district should be drawn on that basis, in addition to making sure we adhere to the Voting Rights Act to protect the rights of long discriminated against communities. So this latest round of partisan gerrymandering is very troubling, and in particular the fact that there's the elected officials involved, starting with the President of the United States, are not even pretending, not even giving a head fake toward community representation, just saying we're going to manipulate districts for our parties, and that's it.
Yeah, let's get specific about what's wrong with this mid-census redistricting that's happening in Texas and it's threatened elsewhere. I mean, why is this a particularly bad idea?
Yeah, so I mean, we'll start with the premise that the state of Texas, basically every decade for the last 50, 60 years, has had a court rule that the districts that they've drawn were discriminatory against black communities, brown communities. And once again, there's litigation this cycle challenging Texas districts, that congressional maps in particular. So despite this long history of clear racial discrimination, the very likely chance that this current congressional map would also be considered discriminatory, the President of the United States had his henchmen in the Department of Justice write a letter to Texas political leaders arguing that, in fact, these districts were too good to communities of color, that Texas had a responsibility to dismantle their congressional map because of the fact that it gave some minimal opportunity for communities of color to elect their candidate of choice, so that it was Texas' responsibility to dismantle those districts and make them even more unfriendly to communities of color. And Donald Trump said this would be the method in order to simply squeeze five more Republican seats out of this already partisan gerrymandered and racially gerrymandered congressional map.
Isn't this tactic, turning the Voting Rights Act, which we'll get to in a minute, on its head, but getting pretty common. I know here in Florida, they've done it where they point to anybody that wants to change any district line, based on race, saying that's in violation of the Voting Rights Act, when, in fact, the thing things that they're changing are efforts to sort of even the playing field. You know, I mean, isn't that another one of these deals?
Yeah, it's true. Let's sort of start with a basic understanding, right, of where we're coming from, right? For decades and decades, redistricting was used to eliminate the ability of people of color to have an opportunity to elect their preferred candidates, right? Those Black communities, Latino communities, Native communities, Asian communities would be split, sliced and diced, either divided between a bunch of different districts to make sure that they had no political power in any one district, or also, so that sort of cracking, and then the packing side, use redistricting vocabulary, where you'll squeeze all the people of color into one district, give them an absolutely overwhelming majority, way more than's needed to elect their candidate of choice, to make sure that they have no power in anywhere else except that district, when they maybe could be put another in a few others. So with that as the premise, right, the Voting Rights Act was both written and then interpreted by the courts to give an opportunity to undo that long history of discrimination, to say, if you've got, a Black community, Latino community that's relatively concentrated, you can put it in a normally shaped district, and they kind of vote the same, and the majority usually votes against them, and a few other criteria, that you've got to create a district there for them. And, this is, I think, now under threat, right? This has been very effective in ensuring that these communities have representation around the country for decades, and that's under threat. And you see it, as you mentioned, in Florida, which not only has the Federal Voting Rights Act, but also has a Fair Districts Amendment passed in 2010 in a very, very good Republican year, passed overwhelmingly by the voters of Florida to both ban partisan gerrymandering in the state constitution and racial discrimination in redistricting. And you see Governor DeSantis is very eager to dismantle those protections.
Yeah, and let's take it back to the Voting Rights Act. I mean, why is the Voting Rights Act, no longer as effective as it originally was? Doesn't that harken back to a Supreme Court decision in 2013?
Yeah, it sure does. So, the original Voting Rights Act of 1965 created this very creative system for policing America's long history of racial discrimination in voting, right? We used to have this history in which there were sort of, poll taxes, and people were given ridiculous quizzes aimed specifically originally at Black people, African Americans. And the Voting Rights Act said, look, if a jurisdiction, a state, a county, a city that has this long history of racial discrimination in voting, if they want to make any changes to their voting systems, be that where you're putting polling places or what kind of voter registration requirements you're going to place or redistricting maps as well, you're going to have to get that pre-cleared by the federal government. Either that's going to be through the U.S. Department of Justice or through a federal court. And it was one of the most effective pieces of legislation ensure that we lived up to our constitutional ideals in the history of the country. And that preclearance regime was crucial because, in addition, suing on these things is expensive, and you got to find plaintiffs, it's not efficient. So this preclearance regime where you say, look, you've discriminated for decades, you're gonna have to let us know and let us take a look at these voting changes. What the U.S. Supreme Court did in 2013, a case called Shelby County v. Holder, they heard a challenge to this preclearance regime and struck it down. They said, oh, no, you identify these jurisdictions. Times have changed. They're fine now. So we're going to eliminate identification of jurisdictions that you've made in the law in terms of which ones are going to have to preclear their changes. And that basically gutted the whole thing. They said, oh, Congress can fix this. Of course, Congress has had no interest in fixing it, creating a new regime, even though the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act has been brought up several times. The Republican Congress in particular has no interest in its passage. And it's been a huge problem. The jurisdictions have now been free to go back discriminating. Just as a side note, interesting, some studies done in the first few years after the decision, the same jurisdictions that were first identified in the law originally were still the problematic ones, you know, regardless of what, you know, the Chief Justice said in his opinion that, you know, oh, this is an old equation, these jurisdictions are fine. We found that lawsuits that were brought after the fact, which you could still do under a different section of the Voting Rights Act, were really targeted at the same places that were problem children all along. So it's led to a huge proliferation of voter suppression restrictions around the country.
Yeah, I guess it's important to, you know, put a little context in this, you know, that, you know, shortly after the Civil War, you know, when, you know, slaves were freed, certain states realized that, you know, the vast majority of their population were black, and that if they allowed them to vote, you know, in a free and fair way, they'd never, you know, the white guy would never win another election, you know, places like, you know, Mississippi in particular, and, you know, Alabama, you know, that where, you know, if you think about it, I mean, there were plantations that had the owner and his family and sometimes hundreds, but always at least maybe, you know, 50 or 60 slaves. So, you know.
Right. Yeah. And the Civil War ended. Yeah.
Yeah.
It
is.
Right. Yeah. And then for then 100 years, they found creative ways to make it nearly impossible for black people and the descendants of enslaved folks and to actually have a voice. The Democracy and the Voting Rights Act changed that until it was gutted by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, which actually, too, you know, and the reason why I wanted to put that context in there, because it did take, you know, about 100 years because it was started in 1865. And, It wasn't until, you know, 1965 that, you know, there was more, I guess, longer, about 100 years, you know, something was actually done to even that playing field. You know, yeah, that's, you know, but I thought after we elected Barack Obama as president, racism was done in this country.
yeah, it's not.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, sort of, that was like a John Roberts, I think. He didn't say that, but that was something that came up in 2013, you know.
Right.
You know, racism. There was no more racism in America. We have elected a, you know, black man as president of the United States.
Right. So let's dismantle the protections that got us here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'll tell you, well, you know, those of us who are worried about allowing Republicans to retain control of the House that has not, and it seems will not do its job to oversee the executive branch, will spell the end of democracy in this country. Is the effort by blue states, notably California, to redistrict, to add Democratic seats justified now?
Well, this is what Common Cause decided as an organization. We're going to sort of pick and choose where we put our resources, right? We are not fans of partisan gerrymandering, no matter who does it. We have a long history of opposing it in Republican and Democratic states. But California's effort doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? It is in fact, an attempt to push back on an authoritarian march, by this president, right? To win seats in Congress that his party didn't really earn through the manipulation of districts in red states that are willing to go along. So what we've said is we're going to take a look. We're going to apply some fairness criteria to states that decide to do a mid-decade redistricting, you know, to figure out is it, you know, is what sort of California and other states do proportional to, you know, the threat? Is the public get to be involved in the process? Is there some protections against racial discrimination? Do leaders support federal reform? Do they endorse in the long term independent redistricting? And is this time limited, right? Do we say that this unique process is just for this cycle and in response to what the president is doing? And if it meets those fairness criteria, which California did, we're gonna sit on the sidelines. We're gonna be neutral. So that's what we decided to do, you know, to take a look at these, you know, responses to the Trump administration's mid-decade gerrymanders in proper context.
Okay, yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second. For those just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Dan Vicuña from Common Cause. But there is, you know, kind of a difference between the way Texas draws its maps and California draws its maps. Doesn't, you know, California have, you know, an independent committee that draws its map?
That's right. Well, that's normally the case. Yeah, so that's why, you know, the governor and the California legislature had to go to the people to get this approved, to get a different approach approved. Because, you know, California's Independent Redistricting Commission, which is something that California Common Cause and our allies really drafted into existence and got past the finish line in 2008 and 2010. And they've had great success in hearing from the public, getting stories, drawing districts based not on partisanship, but based on community needs. And, you know, what this California response does is it puts aside that commission's work, you know, for just this cycle to engage in what is sort of a proportional response to Texas's gerrymander, right, to get five Democratic seats out of the California delegation, five more Democratic seats. And it puts aside the work of the commission for the next few years. But the commission, which has done amazing work, does come back in 2030. So, you know, like I said, we have a longstanding principle of supporting independent districting, and California's model has become the gold standard. But we do have to take a look at, you know, this putting it aside for this cycle in the larger context of, you know, of Texas and other states and the president's authoritarian march to steal seats, you know, away from, people of color. So that's why we've decided we'll stay neutral and we'll apply these fairness criteria, and California passed theirs. Texas obviously did not pass our fairness criteria as the first domino in its effort to discriminate against people of color.
Yeah, you know, I'm just curious. I mean, I know, you know, the way they draw these lines, you know, now with the technology can be, you know, pretty specific. But, you know, is there a possibility like in Texas this could backfire, that they could actually lose seats?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Yes, that's called, you know, and sort of called a dummy mander, where, you know, you think you're getting one thing out of a map, and, you know, and maybe not. And, you know, the way Texas is doing it is, you know, it's shaving off Republican voters in very comfortable Republican seats to put them in neighboring districts, right, to give some of their incumbents what used to be, you know, very, very large Republican registration and voting advantages. To much smaller ones. So it's hard to say. Gerrymandering has become a pretty exact science. So I don't know if I would put my money on the redraw falling apart for Republicans. It may in fact do exactly what was intended to do, ignore the will of the people and steal seats for one party, the Republicans. But there's a risk. You never know if it's a wave election, that Republican voters that they thought would be reliable might not be. So, you know, hard to say how it's going to play out.
Yeah. So, you know, what's the end game here? I mean, will everyone need to move to a district of like-minded people to feel that their vote counts, you know, and what that's going to do to diminish the polarization that seems to be hobbling sensible policymaking?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think people move for a variety of reasons, and politics tends to not be that. So I think, you know, realistically, what's going to happen if there's no federal oversight, if there's no ban nationally on partisan gerrymandering? You know, there's a bill that passed the House in the first couple of years of the Biden administration for the first time requiring independent redistricting commissions for all states that have, you know, more than one House district. You know, federal protections, federal oversight are essential. Otherwise, this could happen after every election. You see the legislature waste taxpayer dollars to get together to do a redraw, to make districts confusing, to make them unresponsive to the voters, to ensure that voters cannot hold elected officials accountable. And we'll just see this cycle going on every couple of years, which is absolute insanity. So I think we need federal protections and federal law, like the John Lewis Voting Rights Endorsement Act and For the People Act and other federal restrictions on engaging in this kind of nonsense.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you noted earlier in the interview, you know, this is, you know, critical to, you know, communities receiving, you know, the help that they need and basically stop the gridlock. In Congress and elsewhere in government, when, you know, things right now are pretty polarized, you know, it's only going to make it worse.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, when districts are designed to be preordained for one party or the other, then the only election that really matters is the primary, and that does encourage people not to compromise, to not listen to the other party's voters in their district, and you just see an increased ugliness in our politics. But, you know, the main thing is, as you noted, yeah, people need to make an argument about being represented for reasons that are just their basic economic health and safety, like I said, environmental issues are just various concerns that are related to their day-to-day lives, and that's what representation should be about, not about just being sort of within, you know, at the whims of politicians and their need for greater partisan control. So that's why we really need some federal reforms to make it right.
Yeah, I've read that, you know, the president is putting pressure on, you know, Indiana to, you know, pull a Texas there and do some redistricting of their own. You know, do you know of any other states that, you know, are considering, you know, this kind of mid-census redistricting?
Yeah, you know, Indiana's one, and we've seen some resistance. You know, and let's be real, I don't know that elected officials really want to be spending their time doing this, but they're going to, you know, the Republican Party is now sort of trained to be the cult of Donald Trump, and so they're unlikely to bow down. But some Indiana legislators are pushing back. But another place, you know, is Missouri, where it's currently a 7-2 map in favor of Republicans. I mean, even that is not really proportional to how people actually vote in the state, even though it's like a, you know, it is a red state. But they want to change that to an 8-1 map by dismantling representation for Kansas City and dividing that into four Republican seats and stretching it out, you know, into the rural areas. And we've also, you know, right there in Florida, you know, the governor, despite, you know, I think they're being plenty to do in terms of kind of cost of living issues and, you know, kind of emergency preparedness. You know, the governor DeSantis is also talking about bringing in legislators for a special session to revamp a map that he, you know, got a rubber stamp on from a court just like a couple months ago. You know, this was litigated, and, you know, the governor, in kind of an unusual move a few years ago, demanded a particular map, and this is usually the legislature's job, got what he wanted, people sued, still got what he wanted, and now suddenly a couple months later, it's not good enough. So we got to spend taxpayer dollars to get a special session and do another redraw and a manipulation of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's become a bit of a gerrymandering wildfire, and the people that get left out are the public, the voters.
Okay, yeah. You know, it's coming down to the end here, but I got to ask, bring up one last thing. I mean, the mid-census mm-hmm. redistricting is just one of the tricks that may be played in 2026 to suppress the vote. You know, now the president is claiming, of course, with no proof, that mail-in ballots are inherently corrupt. Is that true?
Yeah. No. I mean, mail-in ballots have an absolutely long history of being an effective means for military voters overseas, people who live overseas, people who have disabilities, or, you know, they're working folks who have a hard time getting to the polls on kind of one prescribed day. You know, and this was also, we should mention, good enough for Donald Trump in 2020, who cast a mail ballot. You know, good for thee, not for me. You know, 30% of ballots cast in the 2024 election were done by mail. There's zero proof of any problem with it. And, you know, let's just as a reminder of where he got this idea. This was after a discussion with Vladimir Putin, who told him, oh, mail, you know, mail ballots. So Donald Trump has taken his lessons on democracy from Putin, and that kind of tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that note, I want to thank you, Dan Vicuña, from Common Cause for, you know, making time for us today. Please tell my listeners a little bit more about how they can learn more about these important issues and Common Cause's stance on them.
Yeah, go to commoncause.org, you know, check out what's going on. You know, I know you're in Florida. We've definitely got a staffed up operation, a robust, strong operation pushing back on this authoritarian march. So check out what we're up to. Get on some of our lists, and we'll keep you updated and tell you when it's time to pound the pavement and go knock on doors or call your legislators or write emails and just to get involved.
Great. Thanks again. You have a great day, Dan.
You too. Thank you.
Great. Bye.
Bye.
As you must have heard by now, the political activist and founder of Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk, was assassinated Wednesday afternoon at an event in a college campus in Utah. Kirk was notable for having built a massive following that influenced many young people without ever winning or, in fact, running for public office. In response, comments from both sides of the aisle decry the increasing prevalence of political violence. Are we not the country that every 4 years changes its leadership without bloodshed? But some have already seized on this horrific crime as more evidence that only the other side is to blame for this kind of activity, following reports of a couple of responses and the responses to them. President Donald Trump quickly placed blame for conservative activist Charlie Kirk's assassination on the rhetoric of the radical left, despite no evidence yet indicating the shooter's motive. In a video message posted by the White House Wednesday evening, Trump mourned the loss of Kirk, a fierce ally of the president's, who helped Trump to build support among young conservatives. After praising Kirk for his commitment to his Christian faith, Trump pivoted to blaming the shooting on the radical left, claiming that people who described Kirk as a Nazi are directly responsible. It's long past the time for all us Americans in the media to confront the fact that violence and murder are the tragic consequence of demonizing those with whom you disagree, Trump said. For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today, and it must stop now. There is currently no suspect in custody, nor are there any indications from investigators of the shooter's possible motive. Trump said the administration would track down every person who contributed to this atrocity. He then went on to list several acts of violence he blamed on the left, including the 2024 assassination attempt against him, the shooting at a congressional baseball team practice on 2017 that left Rep. Steve Scalise injured, in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last year. Radical left political violence has hurt too many innocent people and taken too many lives, Trump said. Trump did not mention any of the many recent examples of violence against left-leaning politicians, including the shooting of two Democratic lawmakers in Minnesota this summer. Trump's comments are likely to fuel further calls from his most fervent supporters to seek retribution for Kirk's death. On Fox News, host Jesse Waters vowed to avenge Kirk's death. Everybody's accountable, he said. Billionaire and erstwhile Trump ally Elon Musk offered a similar message to the president on X. The left is the party of murder. I will not second-guess any decision made by people in a position who have more knowledge of the behind-the-scenes, so to speak, but must admit, it seems although speech never warrants killing, discussing the dangerous nature of it should not be prohibited as insensitive. Political analyst Matthew Dowd has been fired from MSNBC after his comments about the death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, according to a network source. During MSNBC's coverage of the Kirk shooting, anchor Katie Tour asked Dowd about the environment in which a shooting like this happens. Dowd responded with the following about Kirk. He's been one of the most divisive, especially divisive younger figures in this, who is constantly sort of pushing this sort of hate speech or sort of aimed at certain groups. And I always go back to hateful thoughts to lead to hateful words, which then lead to hateful actions. And I think that is the environment we are in. You can't stop with these sort of awful thoughts you have and then saying these awful words and not expect awful actions to take place. And that's the unfortunate environment that we're in. The remarks sparked outrage across social media, and MSNBC President Rebecca Kuntler issued an apology in response. She slammed Dowd's comments as inappropriate, insensitive, and unacceptable. We apologize for his statements as has he, Kuntler said in a statement shared with MSNBC Public Relations X account. There is no place for violence in America, political or otherwise. Dowd issued his own apology for his commentary on Blue Sky account. He wrote, I apologize for my tone and words. Let me be clear. I in no way intended for my comments to blame Kirk for this horrendous attack. Let us all come together and condemn violence of any kind. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Dan Vicuña from Common Cause for making time for us today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. With Amy Goodman.